A prominent country being Palestine and Iran. So next we have the National Officer of Stop the War Coalition itself, John Rees, who has come all the way up here from London. So we're going to have to give him a huge applause for that. Come on, John, take it away.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation to speak here this evening. I guess what I want to try and do is to analyse why it is that after everything that's happened in the so-called war on terror in the last 10 years, despite the disastrous and still ongoing war in Afghanistan, despite the catastrophe in Iraq, we find ourselves now listening to eerily and frighteningly familiar rhetoric coming from the United States and its allied governments about Iran. Not only that, we find ourselves in a familiar policy position, that sanctions are being imposed, and as Nada, the first speaker, said, no option, as they repeatedly tell us, is being left off the table, which we all know stands for we may well, and we reserve the right to engage in a military attack on Iran. Now, this seems, I think to many of us, scarcely believable. How can it conceivably be that with so much damage done, even to the standing of the governments that were engaged in the Afghan and the Iraq wars, how can it conceivably be that they're talking like this in respect of another country? And I think that this is an argument that we have to address, because I think that an attack on Iran is a serious possibility, and I think that we have to prepare people around us with the arguments about why that is possible and why it should be opposed. And I think we have to open up a new phase of campaigning to do our very best to ensure that the anti-war movement prevents that kind of possibility if it possibly can. And so I think the key to understanding why this possibility is now before us, and it is before us in a very serious way. It's not just that the major imperial powers are talking like this. If you look at the conference and near Tel Aviv recently, where Ehud Barak from the Israeli government spoke, and he put it like this. He said, we are in the same situation now with regard to Iran that we were with regard to Egypt before the 67 war. In other words, we are in the position where we are considering a preemptive attack. That's what that language meant. And we know from the deployment of American and indeed British forces in the Gulf of Hormuz that the military apparatus for such an attack exists. We know that twice in the recent past, the US administration has had to intervene with the Israeli government to stop them having an air attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Once in the final weeks of the Bush administration, when at that point the Israelis were running practice air flights between Tel Aviv out towards Cyprus into the Mediterranean for the exact same distance as between Tel Aviv and Tehran, the Bush administration said, no, now's not the time to do it. And more recently, the Obama administration has had to send the same message to Israel. So there are very clear indications, both in word and in deed, that we are quite close to the trigger point of an attack on Iran. The real difficulty, I think, is not understanding that. I think anybody who's listening attentively to what's being said and what is being done can see that. The more difficult thing is to explain why it is and why they might conceivably actually act on this project. And to understand that, we have to look at the unfinished business of the Iraq war itself. Because the Iraq war for the American administration and its allies was about establishing in the Middle East regime change in Iraq, which would provide for the West a pro-Western, pro-business, geopolitical base of operations in the Middle East. That was the purpose of the Iraq war. It was the purpose of the Iraq war from long before 9/11, when the neoconservative think tanks were writing letters in 1998 when Clinton was still president, they were saying this, that we essentially, in 1979, we lost the Shah of Iran, and that was the second pillar after Israel of US foreign policy in the Middle East. We attempted and succeeded for a period of using Saudi as a base, particularly during the first Gulf War, but that became so unstable. Indeed, it produced Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. That's where they emerged from a split among Saudi opinion about this, and the Saudis eventually had to ask the Americans to leave. This left them without such a base in the Middle East, and the Iraq War was about re-establishing a second centre of operations in the Middle East. Now, whatever you think happened in the Iraq War, that wasn't the outcome. The Americans did not have the catastrophic failure of the Iraq project means that they emerged from that conflict damaged and without that base of operations. Of course, the companies are still there. Of course, the influence is still there. It's not they gained nothing from it, but they certainly didn't gain the kind of absolutely rock-solid pillar of reaction, armaments dump, air base, military facility that the Shahs of Iran offered them before 1979. In fact, it's turned out even worse than they thought it was going to in the last months of the occupation. They argued for, attempted to achieve with the Iraqi government, a status of forces agreement which would have left some 50 to 60,000 American troops in Iraq. In the end, even that was unsustainable for the Iraqi government, and the whole lot of the Americans had to clear out. Now, the aftermath of that disaster of the Iraq War has, and we are deep into the territory of unintended consequences here, but the unintended consequence of the Iraq War is actually to create Iran as a stronger regional power than it was before. The Americans have always had a problem with Iran since the 1979 revolution. That was why they ended up arming Saddam Hussein in the first place as a counterbalance to Iran. The whole purpose of the Iraq invasion was to consolidate that as a counter base, and they lost it. So now they have a very, very big strategic problem in the entirety of the Middle East. And I don't need to underline why the Middle East, geopolitically, in resource terms, is absolutely central for American capitalism. You only have to listen to the noises about the Gulf of Hormuz, never mind about the resources, to understand this question. And it's not just Iran. When the Americans, when you look at, if you are in the unfortunate position of viewing the Middle East from the position of Langley, Virginia, where the CIA headquarters are, you don't just see Iran as an emerging regional power. You see Iran linked now, actually, to a sizable section of the Iraqi government itself. Then you see Iran linked to the Assad regime in Syria. Then you see Iran linked to Hezbollah. Then you see Iran linked to Hamas. And you've got a giant strategic problem in the Middle East, and you've got a strategic problem that you simply cannot not deal with. It is not possible to allow this situation to develop in this way without some intervention from the major imperial powers and from the United States in particular. Now, there is a particular timescale attached to this, and it's a particular timescale attached to it because of the development of nuclear facilities in Iran. This isn't just a strategic problem that you have to deal with sometime. This isn't a strategic problem that you have to deal with maybe in 5 years, or maybe in 10 years, or that you can take the long road around with, because there's a clock ticking, and the clock that's ticking is the development of a nuclear capability by Iran. Now, I'm talking real politique terms, and this is the way in which the American State Department and its associated bodies look at things. We'll deal with the ideological arguments about nuclear weapons in a minute. But for the Americans, and even more so for their Israeli allies, this is a crucial question. This is a timing question, and it can't be allowed to go on forever. The Israeli state is simply not willing to, simply will not tolerate a situation where there is another nuclear power in the Middle East. The Israel's whole defence policy rests on it being the only nuclear power in the Middle East, and it simply will not tolerate, and it makes this absolutely clear, there's no room for doubt about their position on this. They are absolutely unwilling to do this, and their view is that an attack on Iran has to happen before that capability is developed, because if they try to attack it after that capability is developed, it's quite clear that they are in a much more disadvantageous situation. So these are not suppositions, they're not mad conspiracy theories, they're not beyond the pale of imagination. This is the real political discussion that is now taking place among the foreign policy elite of the United States and its allies. If you want to look at its house journal, which is the Foreign Affairs magazine, you can see the lead article this week, I think written by a former senior official, I think probably off the Iran desk, if I remember rightly, in the CIA, where he spells this out in absolutely unimpeachably clear terms. So this is the situation that I believe the major imperial powers are in, and that's why I think that it is a live question about an attack on Iran. Now, I don't believe that the attack will be like the invasion of Afghanistan or the invasion of Iraq. That is, it won't be a land invasion and an attempted occupation. I think actually Iran is already not in as weakened a position as Iraq was. I don't believe that they have partly because of the work of the international anti-war movement, actually, that they have the base of political support to be able to sustain this. I don't think after 10 years of failed wars, they're in a militarily, not in hardware terms, but in a kind of morale sense, capable of doing this. But this isn't what's being canvassed. We're not talking about an occupation like the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. We're talking essentially about an air raid on the nuclear facilities in Iran. Now, that poses some difficulties for us. It means that the preparation of public opinion and also the military preparation that's necessary isn't the same as the invasion. So we won't see it coming in the same way. If it's anything like, for instance, the 1986 air raid on Libya, it can be happening before you actually hear about it. So we have a business of alert to do, a business of preparation to do, and we have to convince supporters that this is something that we need to be active on now, even if the same preparation in terms of military deployment isn't visible. Because even though it will be, as in my view, an air raid, it will have disastrous consequences. It will not, militarily it may be like the raid on Libya, politically it won't be. The raid on Libya happened, was over, there weren't massive consequences. However you judge that, there weren't. This, there will be. This will not be one raid and it's over. This will be the beginning of a sequence of events which draws us into a very much longer, deeper and more prolonged conflict in the whole of the Middle East. The Iranians will respond in a variety of ways, directly militarily themselves, and as they've declared, probably through terrorist activities as well. It will drag in other states in the area into the conflict. It will, because of the links between the Iranian state and other political forces in the region, ignite Iraq, ignite Lebanon, and so forth and so on. So the consequences of a lesser form of military action than the occupations may well be greater than even the invasion of Iraq was, and therefore it's at least a serious a prospect that we need to address. I mean, I'll say a few things about the arguments that are put against us now. One is, of course, that aren't you opposed to nuclear weapons? Well, yes, I am, actually. I'm especially opposed to them in this country, in Israel, and in the United States. And if they were serious about this question, of course, the offer that they would make to the Iranian regime is that we will have a nuclear-free Middle East. That would be an irrefutable offer. It would be an enormous shift to deal fairly and evenly with Israel and any other state in the region. It would be virtually impossible for anybody not to support. But I think we all know that offer is not going to be forthcoming. And if you aren't willing to do that, if you aren't willing to treat equally the states that contain and produce these absolutely hideous weapons, what you're really saying is that there are some states in the world that can be trusted with a weapon that can annihilate humanity, and there are some states that simply aren't. That the Iranians are in some way so psychologically disturbed or politically unreliable that they will do things with nuclear weapons that, say, the state of Pakistan will not. Now, that frankly is not really a believable or credible argument. The argument is put to us that the regime, and this is almost wearily old argument now after 10 years, that the regime is an unpleasant regime in Iran, and aren't you in favour of changing it? Well, that, I believe, as I believed in the case of the regime in Afghanistan, as I believed in the case of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that business is the business of the Iranian people themselves. It is nobody else's business to go about changing their government. They have the right, exactly the same right as we would demand of our own people, that they have the right to change their government. We would not accept, no person in this country would accept for a single minute, that any other country had the right to change the regime in this country other than the people who live in this country. It is a basic, fundamental, elementary right of self-determination, and nothing in the world can convince people that this should be abrogated, that it should be acceptable that some other force from the other side of the world, simply because it is richer and better armed than any other country in the world, has the right to tell other countries in the world who should be and shouldn't be their political leaders. Now, this used to be a harder argument, the other side of the Arab Spring, because we were told that these people were living in countries that were so dictatorial, that they were so oppressive, that there was absolutely no possibility that these poor benighted sods in Arabia could possibly get rid of the dictators over them. Well, that really is no longer a credible argument. We have seen in Tunisia and in Egypt especially that people in this part of the world are more than capable, perhaps more than capable, perhaps more capable than other people in other parts of the world, perhaps more capable, terrible thought, than white Westerners of getting rid of unpopular regimes. So no more colonial argument that there are some people who are capable of creating revolutionary change and there are some people who are not. That simply is an argument which is finished after the course of the last year. So the nuclear argument is hypocrisy, and the argument about tyranny is an unacceptable colonial argument about the capabilities of ordinary people in other parts of the world to change their own government. But we, therefore, are left with a duty, and it is the duty to deal with the people who are at the heart of this war machine. It is more difficult if you are in Tehran. It is more difficult if you are in Syria or in Palestine to deal directly with the people who are responsible for the problem here. Because the people who are responsible for the problem created it and continue to create it in Washington, in London, in Paris, in Berlin. That is where the heart of this machine lies, and it is where we are. So it is our particular duty to deal with them. It is our particular duty to say to them, you are lecturing us day in, day out about how we cannot afford to have a health service, to have an education service, that we cannot afford to get by without mass employment or cuts or redundancies. But you always tell us that you have millions of pounds to destroy other people's countries. That is an unacceptable argument for us. We have the duty to say to them, you have twice in a decade taken poor people from this part of the world and told them to go and kill poor people in some other part of the world on behalf of people who are so rich that they will never have their sons and daughters put in harm's way for any purpose whatsoever, except perhaps that they might be trampled to death in the New Year sales at Harrods. That is unacceptable to ordinary people in this country. It is unacceptable that the colonial worldview of the Victorian era, that there are some people who are simply so benighted and so incapable of ruling themselves that they require the military assistance of the West in order to do so. These are all ideas who have long, long, long ago gone past their sell-by date, and it is time once again for the anti-war movement to bring that message firmly to the hearts of the governments who are now talking as if they might conceivably, possibly, do the unthinkable thing of setting fire to the Middle East.
Just like to say, while John gets a sip of a drink, that I think not a truer word could be said there. What a fantastic talk. Thank you so much for enlightening us with that. Also to pick your brain further in terms of your knowledge and experience.